Today's interview is with Melanie Miller from The Profit Lovers. Now, let me tell you something about this particular day. I was in launch for Radcasters. I was closing the doors. I had had a very disappointing few days. Everything kind of happened at the last moment, but that last moment hasn't happened yet. All morning, I was bawling my eyes out. I had been thrown straight back into the office collective failure, and I was just beside myself. I felt like a total fuck up, a total failure, and I had made business very, very personal. So it was so timely that we had this conversation. Melanie is all about the unsexy side of business, looking at the numbers and knowing that it's not actually personal. So this conversation was a game changer for me. And that's what I love about this podcast. Not only do I get to meet amazing women with like insane stories like Melanie, but I also get to, you know, I always get something personal out of the conversations that we have. There's always a lesson for me that is just absolute perfectly timed. And I have to say, I have the utmost respect for Melanie. During this conversation, we talk a lot about anxiety and the impact that it's had on her and her business. This is something that she doesn't speak about openly. And I'm so honored to have people like Melanie come on and be willing to really share the stuff. You know, the stuff that isn't on the Instagram feed. So I think you're really going to love this conversation. And if you're digging it, hit subscribe because I have some seriously amazing stuff coming your way in 2017. And now on with the show. Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
The reason that I got into doing what I'm doing is that sadly my mum passed away a few years ago. And so prior to that, I was working in business. I was a business coach. And when she passed away, two things happened. I got really, really sad that she'd spent the last, you know, few years of her life that she should have been enjoying worrying about money because she had no savings, no insurance, no superannuation, no assets. And so she relied 100% on me to fund her treatment and her care. And so I was sad that she had to worry about that. And I thought, this is crazy. She had a small business that could have been great. And it wasn't because she never had the confidence just to go for it. And, you know, the other thing was that I just didn't really want to drag my ass around the Gold Coast all day, going from client to client to client, working in this business. And while I love coaching clients and I love talking business, she's not really scalable, right? And I thought, if any time is the time to completely reassess what you're doing, now is it. So I took all of the knowledge that I had and channeled it into online courses. And that's why I am where I am today, or what I'm doing today. And that's kind of the main, I guess, catalyst that changed Melanie's view on the world and what I decided that I was going to do with myself. Because prior to that, I hadn't really thought that much about how what I did impacted other people. Does that sound weird?
No.
You have a job or you have a business, right? And you go there and you work every day and you get your paycheck and you think about things like going on holidays and buying homes and that sort of thing. But I hadn't ever thought more externally than that. And yes, I knew that I was helping people in their businesses and I knew I was having a huge impact. I've had clients. I had one client a few years ago that was, he had mentioned to me that suicide was on his mind prior to working with me because he didn't know how to get everything back in control. So yes, you know, you have an impact. But then when my mum died, I had this really weird, like, I'm going to change the world moment. So obnoxious. And so now I'm just running with the whole obnoxious thing and actually really quite focused on how I can influence women to embrace their businesses like it's an asset and like it's something that can support their families, not just some side adventure.
When I was a kid, I was a bit of a crusader. You know, I would round up all my toys, put them on the front, you know, yard and sell them for charity and sell lemons door to door, raising money. I had a very strong social conscience, I guess.
Yeah.
And
I fear where this question is going.
You want to anticipate it?
I had no social conscience. I think you're going to ask me if this was like some fire that always existed in my belly, yeah. And you know, when my mum passed, it was ignited. No, no social conscience. I was an incredibly shy kid, painfully shy kid, zero self-confidence. And if I could have just hidden away from the world, I was very happy. So there was no inkling that this would be anything that I would do. And in fact, I think that the people who knew me when I was a kid think that this is all very strange to see me not in that way, to see me have, you know, obviously come out of my shell quite a bit since then. But yeah, this was not something I didn't ever have like a roadside juice stall or sell my goodies on the, you know, and you know, I didn't do any of that. No.
And so what were you like at school? What was your childhood like?
My childhood was different and unusual. It wasn't an easy childhood. It was quite difficult. We lived a very, my dad was in jail, basically. There you go. So it was a different way to grow up. We had financial struggles. We had that, you know, that struggle of what the perception is that everybody else sees and what you know is the truth at home. So that was quite difficult as a kid to get your head around how to navigate that, how to be someone completely different in public than you knew, you know, what was going on at home. Both my parents had, you know, mental health issues. And so growing up, until I was maybe about 10 or 11, I didn't know that there was anything different about my upbringing. I just thought that I knew that other people's dads maybe were in jail, but I didn't really know that anything else was all that different. And then, you know, as you get into your teenage years, it becomes so apparent that you are very, very different and that your experience is very, very different. And so, you know, it was a weird childhood. It was different. And it's at this point now that I'm at my age, which I'm not telling you what it is, but it's, it's at this point now where I'm starting to realize the impact of having that different childhood and realizing you have the conversation over a dinner party. Somebody will say, "Do you, where did you grow up?" Or you'll start talking, you know, about your childhood. When I tell people about my childhood, they're like, "Whoa, you know, I don't even understand any part of what you're telling me right now." So it's only been as I've gotten older and older that I'm realizing how weird it was and how, you know, difficult navigating that was. But also the advantage of now knowing that without any of that, I wouldn't be who I am or where I am today. And I am very self-sufficient, let me tell you. There is nothing that I won't or can't try on my own, to the point where I wouldn't pay the car dealer to put new headlights in because I knew I could do it myself. And like, I drive a BMW. If you're going to drive a BMW, you probably shouldn't be trying to do your own maintenance. But because of the way I was brought up, I'm like, no, I'm not paying you $650 to put new headlights in. I'm going to go on YouTube and figure it out myself. So there's an amazing amount of self-sufficiency that's come with the way that I was brought up. And that just sounds like my parents were really shitty people. They're not. They were, my mum was a lovely woman. She just had her own mental health issues that she was dealing with and her own childhood she was dealing with. And my dad had his own kind of set of issues as well. So it's, I guess in hindsight, I can probably see how what I do now is driven by some of the experiences I had as a kid, yet I didn't ever intentionally take that route. Do you know, a lot of people have experiences when they're a kid and that drives them. Mine was very passive. It was probably like maybe a little voice in the back of my head that I wasn't ever really paying that much attention to. And then you find yourself here and you think, wow, now I see how it's all come full circle.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the gifts that your upbringing gave to you that you use these days besides the self-sufficiency thing?
Definitely empathy. I get you will never ever know what's going on in someone else's life. And so I don't have probably the same judgments that I know that other people might have. I never ever make an assumption about what's going on behind someone else's closed door. I do try not to be too judgmental about how other people behave, I guess. Because once again, I'm sure that, you know, from having the upbringing that I had, people made a lot of judgments about who we were based on our circumstance, and none of it was true. So I'm quite cautious there as well. I've also got a bit of a no bullshit attitude where I don't really probably do all that well with other people's excuses. So I don't want to hear week after week, month after month, why you can't, because you can. Stop making excuses and just do it. So while I do have that empathy for somebody else's situation, I probably don't have that patience with people being self-indulgent with their own shit, their own stuff. And I guess that probably comes from a bit of the childhood too, where you weren't allowed to be self-indulgent and feel sad and sit in your bedroom and cry all day about something. You just had to get on with it, and somebody else always had a bigger problem than you did. So it felt like everything else paled in comparison, right? They're probably the things that I've really bought from that childhood. I think that kind of drive just to, and it comes back to self-sufficiency, right? But that drive or ambition just to march through and keep going regardless of the situation, that definitely got me through my mum's cancer diagnosis. And it got me to a position where I was able to, I guess, get her whatever she needed to make those final years as pleasant as possible. And so, you know, I didn't wait around for anything to happen for her. I didn't wait for somebody to tell me, yes, she can have that medication, or yes, she can have that care she needs. I just went out and got it for her. No pissing about, no excuses, no waiting. So that's probably something definitely that I've brought from my childhood.
Yeah, I need you to pass some of that on to me right now. Thank you very much. I've just had a week where I've just, really sat in the space of, well, I've, you know, that image of the entrepreneur's life where it's like that crazy up, down, up, down, up, down. I've been in launch, and it's just been exhausting and disappointing and, you know, just like almost soul destroying. And I have this story that goes along with it due to my, I don't know if you know much about my background, but I had a co-working space in Byron Bay, and it was an abysmal failure. It cost me $100,000. It almost ruined me as a human being. I lost all faith in humanity. I almost actually took my own life because the tax office came knocking and I didn't have 16 grand that I owed them, and I couldn't see any way out, and it was just really shit. And then I've just gone through healing from that. That was 2013, then I closed it. Healing from that, starting this podcast because I wanted to have other conversations about the shit, not just the shine, you know, move away from the Instagram feed and actually have open, honest conversations about how it can be tough, you know, and that we all experience self-doubt and all that kind of jazz. And then started Radcasters, and initially had great success, and then it's kind of teetered out, and this launch has just been really disappointing. And I've just found myself back in that place I was 3 years ago, when it became really it's become kind of personal again, and it feels like, you know, I don't know, just yeah, I'm just stuck in this story, and yeah, looking to get out of it. So all I needed really was to have this conversation so I can have some permission to get over myself.
I can give you permission, but then you know, I've got to be honest and say that I still get stuck in my own bullshit all the time as well. Of course we all do. And you know, even though I can kick someone else's ass and say to them, you know, just deal with it and get on with it. Next step, we're over it. We're not talking about this again. There is still all of those things that I have that haunt me from my upbringing. I have this, I've managed to break it with the help of Kylie Patchett. I've managed to break this weird conversation I had in my head where I was standing in the lounge room of my mum's home. I moved out of home when I was really young, so, and I was still finishing high school when I was, you know, out in the real world. And so I'd come back to my mum's for whatever reason, and I was standing in her lounge room and my father was there. I had told him that I had applied to go to university, which should be. And as I was, you know, growing up, it never occurred to me that that was an option for me. It never, ever once occurred to me. Even when all of my friends were talking about going to university, it just, and I feel like maybe even for them, it wasn't maybe something that was going to be open for me as well, because nobody even asked me. It was like I was left out of the conversation, because how could that girl who came from that background ever go to university, right? And even a guidance counselor, I was telling a friend the other day that a guidance counselor said to me, listen, let's just be honest about what your future holds. You need to go and get yourself whatever job you can find, even though I had a really, really good OP. So in Queensland, we do OP. So I got really good results in school. People were still saying, you're just probably going to be a bit of a loser, really. And so I had this conversation with my dad, and I told him I was in my early 20s and I was leaving the job that I had so that I could go to university. And I was doing a science degree, and I was really, really proud of that, really excited and kind of overwhelmed with the feeling that that could be something that I could do. And I think that that for me was that first step off point to changing everything about who I was, in terms of I don't have to follow their path. I don't have to, you know, work in the same horrible job or do the things that they did. I can do something totally different. And university signified that for me, right? And so I said to him, I've been accepted into university. And he said, you lazy little cow, you're not going to be lying around this home mooching off us, essentially, while we pay your way, kind of thing. And it was really shocking to me, because I'd moved out of home when I was really young. I'd never asked them for anything. I'd been very, very self-sufficient. And so he had, and it wasn't about me. It was about his interpretation of what going to university was. I guess he thought that you just went a couple of hours a week and you partied all the time and somebody else paid your bills. I don't know. But when I said to him, I don't want to do my job anymore, I hate going to work, he said to me, everybody hates their job. And that was kind of where the conversation ended. And it was like I was being self-indulgent by choosing to go to university. It was almost a bit like, how dare you? Everybody hates their job. Who the hell do you think you are? And it just hit me like this massive, you know, verbal slap across the face. And I still went to university, mind you. And interestingly, he was the one standing in the crowd, kind of taking the kudos for it all when I was, you know, walking across that graduation stage. So, I definitely believe that if you were to ask him today, he would say that that was a real regret, treating me like that, because he celebrates that success now. But definitely those words he said to me, nobody likes their job. And so anytime I found myself feeling happy in a job, I found a way to feel unhappy. And so that might mean taking on more hours, taking on a bigger responsibility, taking on somebody else's job, just adding a new level of stress or dislike because nobody likes their job. And so if you're comfortable and you feel good in what you're doing, then something's very wrong about that. And when you are self-employed, that's a really dangerous mindset to have, because I love every minute of being self-employed, and so many times loving this feeling of self-employment and then that little voice going, hang on, you better F this up, because you're not supposed to feel happy here. This is supposed to be uncomfortable. It's supposed to be horrible. So always finding those little ways to make it more difficult than it actually needs to be. That's been a big, long process to break through that. And that has taken, you know, Kylie's assistance to figure out where the negativity was coming from and what those actual words were. And I remember even that light bulb moment of realizing what those words were. It all came flooding back to me. I could remember how warm it was, like the temperature in the air. I could remember exactly where we were standing. I remember what I was looking at. I remember what he was wearing. I remember the tone of his voice. And to think that you file that away, and then you do things that self-sabotage, and you've got to go back and figure out what that thing is and being able to pull that out of the vault. And so then every time I would start to make my business more difficult than it needed to be, or I would start to self-sabotage, I would remember those words and I would have to keep saying to myself, they're not your words. It wasn't your perception. It's not your thoughts. It's not yours to take on. But definitely difficult, right? And totally. I'm sure I've got 100 more of those sitting back there.
And it's so interesting. I find it so interesting because to your dad, it was probably, you know, just a flippant remark that actually he wouldn't even remember saying.
There is no way he would remember saying it. There is no way in the world he would remember saying it. He's a very different man now. You know, I think with age and time comes the realization of things that have gone on in the past and how they've affected other people. And I know that he carries a lot of regret. And so I know that if I said to him, "You said those words to me," I know that he would feel terrible about it. Mm-hmm. And I already know that he feels terrible about the whole university thing. But, you know, he's got to own it, right? When you're a parent, you have a responsibility. I can say this because I'm not a parent.
I can, and a weighs heavy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a huge responsibility, one that was too big for me ever to take on. I didn't take the responsibility on because of my fear that I would screw it up or that I would pass on those same mental health issues, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't face it. And so, you know, he's got to own the weight of the words but I have to own how I use those words as an adult and how much weight or bearing I allow them to have on my life. I learned a very valuable lesson from my mother who was very stuck in the past. And so she used things that had happened when she was very young to justify why she couldn't be successful or why she couldn't do the things she wanted to do as she was older. And she would say things to me like, "You don't understand how hard it is for me. You didn't have my life." And I would think, "Oh my God, where were you? there's no picnic growing up with you, lady." So she wouldn't let it go. And I kept thinking to myself, I don't want to be that. I want to break that habit of dragging every, you know, thing that has been done to you as a child and every bad memory you have of spending Christmas days, you know, visiting your dad in jail where he's giving you, you know, he used to give us these handmade like lighter cases, and they were like leather cases because that would be his like project or whatever. And, you know, that was what you could get your hands on. And so all of those memories, I try not to now use those as an excuse, because I'm an adult now and I've got a brain and I can make different decisions and I can look back at things that have happened and see how they're affecting my life and my business now and choose to deal with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you, what tools do you use to move past that stuff? I know, you know, one of the things that I try to do is ask myself, is it really true? What's in your tool bag?
It's pretty much the same thing. It's always a reference to where did I learn this from? And to spend some time actually thinking about what words I may have heard or what has gone on previously that didn't belong to me. So it's a constant for me questioning of, does this belong to me? Does this fear or this anxiety or this regret or this panic or whatever, does this belong to me? Is it based on something I want for me or some fear I have, or is it something that I've absorbed from somebody else? One of, you know, a downside of my personality and I guess and of being somebody who is quite empathetic of other people and quite sensitive to other people around me, you know, in terms of how they're feeling, I'm a huge sponge for other people's problems. And with that comes that knowledge that a lot of the things I think have probably come from somebody else as well. So it's that constant, is it mine or did I absorb it from somebody else? And can I figure out where I picked it up along the way? And most of the time I'm getting quite good at figuring that stuff out. I wouldn't say I've got any specific tools like tapping or anything like that. I do keep a thankful journal. I have always struggled with anxiety, not something that I, you know, talk too openly about, but hey, I agreed to do.
Yes. And as a fellow anxiety sufferer out of the closet, you know, I think it's quite rife and that most of us are suffering in silence or not even really aware that that's what it is, you know.
It feels like a weird, like a big thing or a weird thing or, you know, like a kind of a negative thing to own. But once again, it's the way that you deal with it that gives you the power. And, you know, for many years, it was just medication. And, you know, at some point I thought I probably don't want to spend, not that the medication had any negative effects, it didn't, but just that I thought, what am I covering here? And so, you know, coming off the medication was difficult. My mental health can be very up and down. And there's a lot of things I need to do to ensure it doesn't go up and down. And one of those things that I started doing was a thankful journal, and it takes 3 or 4 minutes a day. And I would have to say it has as much power as the medication that I spent 20 years taking. I had my first panic attack when I was 16, and I remember it was terrible. I was at school. We were doing rehearsals for a dinner theatre that we were putting on. And I remember that I had to wear like these little red hot pants, and I couldn't find them. My drama teacher was calling us all. We were supposed to be on stage, and I couldn't find these red hot pants. And I started to hyperventilate, and I thought I was going to pass out. And I remember she came in, and she knew my background. She knew what was happening in that very moment. And I remember her holding my hands, and she didn't say anything. But I remember her taking deep breaths, like she was like, breathe along with me. And it took me a few minutes, but I was able to get out of that, you know, that serious panic attack. And so for years after that, I just used medication to make sure that those things didn't happen. That thankful journal and learning, you know, the tools around being mindful about what's going on in your life in the present and being very thankful for what you do have and writing words on a page and taking time to stop and check in with yourself, it really has, you know, had the most amazing effect. You know, it's like a pharmaceutical for me. I'm now learning how to better manage by doing things like keeping a thankful journal. Who thought? So simple. Isn't it true that the simplest solutions are the best?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, the thankful, I used to journal a lot. When I was first diagnosed with depression and anxiety, I used to do the 3-page thing that, Is it Julie Cameron from The Artist Way? She has that morning pages thing. And I used to do it, and it used to give me really great clarity. And then, you know, I don't know, like having a kid, and then, you know, she's in bed with me at 5 a.m. It's like, when do I have time to do this kind of stuff? But last night I was sitting around with a bunch of girlfriends who were just having a chat about the new moon and what we wanted to bring in for this month and, you know, all that kind of cool woo-woo stuff that I love in the closet a little bit, but not that much. And we were just talking, and I was talking about the struggle that I'm having at the moment with this launch being a little disappointing, and is this really what I want? Like, is this really how success looks to me? Is the work worth the return on this? And is it okay to walk away sometimes? And just having this conversation with the women, you know, I have this whole story going on about being mediocre. You know, my success is always mediocre. I'm just kind of like mediocre. Other people have the Midas touch. I don't have the Midas touch. And then we were just kind of talking about it. And as with anything, it's just perception, right? It's just a story and it's perception. And so, yeah, that thankful journal is really cool because it can switch your perception from, oh, look at all the things I lack in my life, being stuck in my victimhood of my story, or it can be, oh my God, look at all the amazing things that I have in my life, bring me more of that, you know? And if someone else has the Midas touch, perhaps it's also possible for me.
I think for me it is more about the flow of how easily the words come out helps me better understand what I might not be acknowledging. So, and when I write my thankful journal every night, let me tell you, some days it's just random crap. Like, I'm thankful that McDonald's serves breakfast all day now. You know, like let me tell you this, it doesn't go too deep a lot of the time. But if I am resisting it, or if I'm struggling to come up with 3 things, I know that I'm there is something else going on. It's like there's a rip beneath the surface. And I know that now is the time to address it. And I think that may be how I am managing the anxiety better than I had been before, is that I feel like I'm getting this pre-warning.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think like a symptom or a side effect of anxiety is that we can catastrophize things too. I don't know. For me, it's definitely been, I've always had a very vivid imagination. And so I can see all of the shit possibilities that could happen potentially.
I see them like I'm watching a movie.
Yeah,
and
totally.
And they get really wild really quickly. Really wild really quickly. I don't know, is that an anxiety sufferer thing to be able to do that? I don't know if that's a specific, because I'm a genius at it, to the point where I was thinking about, you know, when my mum got sick. My mum had been diagnosed with cancer. She didn't tell anybody. And so she'd had it for 2 years with no treatment, didn't say anything to one soul. Nobody knew. And then I went around to her home. I didn't usually do that. We didn't have a particularly close relationship. And I'd gone around to her home. It must be something, you know, like that little weird voice in the back of your head. And I'd found her, and unfortunately she was very, very sick at that point. And I think if it had have been an hour later, she probably wouldn't have been alive. She'd gotten an infection. I was able to get her an ambulance, and we got another year and a half together. But there were, because of the time frame, she was sick so quick. Do you know, it was already 2 years gone. And so the time that I did spend with her, when she got sick, I told her I would move in with her if she'd agree to treatment. I needed the extra time with her to heal some old wounds, and I have a much younger sister, and I wanted her to have time with her mum as well. So I moved in with her, and there were a lot of things we couldn't do because I was working hard to try and cover everything financially, and she was very unwell. And so I had this kind of a little bit of a regret that I didn't take her to this one particular spot that we used to go to down at Greenmount Beach, down at Coolangatta, and I didn't take her on the walk around the headland. But then in my mind, it goes to a place of, oh my God, I could have gotten a wheelchair for her, but oh my God, how hard would that have been to push? And what if I had have slipped? And what if she had have gone over the edge? And oh my, like it just runs off in a very strange direction very quickly.
Very quickly. And it's hard to reel it back in. You know,
a trauma thing, a grief thing, or I don't know if that's an anxiety thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always, as a kid, I always had a very vivid imagination. A lot of people that I know that suffer from anxiety are a bit the same. So it's like, yeah, I don't know. Let's go back to, you know, so you've gone to university. From there, what?
From there, I got 3/4 of the way through and I thought, oh, that probably wasn't the right choice of a degree.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
That's a beautiful thing. But I was also so excited that I was going to walk on that stage. So I kept going. I think I'd probably run out of a little bit of steam too. I think that the direction I would have liked to have taken would have required more support, and support that I didn't have. So when I finished my degree, I did want to go into pharmaceutical sales, and not because it was a passion. Who does that for a passion, right? Probably more because it seemed like the next logical step. And at the same time as I graduated, I got dumped. I was in a three and a half year relationship, and I had my heart broken, and it was the best thing that's ever happened to me because I felt so uncomfortable where I was that I decided to change everything. I got on a plane, a few months later after I'd been dumped and heartbroken and left. I decided to get on a plane and move to Canada, and I had no money. I think I had like $2,000. So crazy now in hindsight. $2,000. I packed my suitcase and I announced to everybody I'm moving to Vancouver. I don't even know I could have pointed out where Vancouver was on a map. But a few weeks earlier, I had run into a friend of mine from school, her mum, and her mum had told me that that's where she was living, and I thought, sounds like a nice place. I didn't even know how to get in contact with her, so it wasn't like I was going there to stay with her or meet up with her or anything. I just decided Vancouver sounded like this awesome place. I went online, I got my visa. It took about, I think, 3 or 4 days to get the visa, and I bought a ticket and I left. When I got there, I realized that everything could be different, as in nobody knew who I was, and I wasn't dragging around any of that past. Even in university, you still have that same group of friends that you go out with, and the Gold Coast is a small place and people know everybody, and you still feel like you're that person that they knew when you were 6 or 7. And so all of the stories that came along with who Melanie was, do you know Melanie's the one whose daddy was in jail, and do you know, all of those stories, I felt like all of a sudden they didn't exist. And I have to say, maybe that's where my confidence changed, because I took a lot of liberties with, you know, who I was telling people I was. And, you know, social media didn't exist then, so there was no way of checking up. And I basically talked myself into a job I was completely unqualified for. And it was a job in sales, and it was for, you know, a gift and homewares company. And it started this love of how the numbers work in business. And it started this love of understanding, you know, just, I guess, people and why people buy and how to get people to buy what you're selling, and even down to how to pack a box correctly. It was just this complete intrigue in this new world that was really exciting to me. And that started the passion for business. I think alongside of that, there was the advantage that the job had a lot of travel. And so I was on a plane usually every, you know, 3 or 4 days. It was consistent crossing the states. And in between those times, I would have a day or two in every different city. And so you see that the world is a really big place, and that everybody doesn't know your story, and you can be whoever the heck you want to be, and you can leave all that bullshit behind. And so it was very successful from that point on. And I do believe it's because I didn't have the cloak of where I'd come from. Do you know, I didn't feel like people were making an assumption about me before they even knew me, or I didn't have that
shadow hanging around.
Shadow is a perfect way to describe it. And so, yeah, I talked myself into a great job and learned everything I could about business. I have a naturally curious mind, as you can tell by wanting to change your own headlights. I don't think that that's necessarily a normal thing to want to know how to do, but I do have a naturally curious mind, and I definitely learn by doing. So wherever I could stick my fingers into someone else's job to figure out what they were doing and why they were doing it, I did it. And that definitely has been career making for me. When I see that somebody goes online and gets a certificate to be a business coach, a little part of my soul dies, because I know what I did to know what I know. And it was 15 years of doing the stuff that nobody else wanted to do, or picking up the jobs when someone was sick, or pure curiosity of wanting to understand. I did everything from learning to put trade show booths together myself to, you know, going to China to figure out how import relationships worked. So that real love of knowing how everything works is, I think, what makes a great coach, because then you can see somebody else's business from a completely different perspective, right? And you've had so much experience around very different areas of business. So that was definitely that getting on that plane to Vancouver is the single best decision I've ever made in my entire life, and it changed things so significantly.
After that,
kind of tripped around the world quite a bit. I spent quite a few years over there, and I was in the US a lot, and I was working in sales and marketing. After that, I came back to Australia, worked in a very similar kind of position, got itchy feet pretty quickly, headed back overseas. And there became a point where I realized that I probably didn't want to spend my whole life on a plane. For a good 10 years of my life, I was just on planes constantly. I was living in hotels. I had this life that I think a lot of people were looking at going, wow, that's so cool. I was lucky enough to fly business class quite a bit. Whenever it was a flight over 4 hours, I flew business. So it looked like a really amazing life. But then I realized that I was missing out on connection and I was missing my friends, and my friends who I consider my family, because I don't really have any family. It's just myself, my sister, you know, my dad's still around and we're working on that relationship, but we don't have, you know, aunts and uncles and cousins and people around in that sense. So my friends have very much been my support system, and they were starting to have kids. And so this role that I was so desperate to play of supporter and auntie, I was missing out on. And I really wanted to be a part of that. So I came back to Australia. I was exhausted. It had been a long, long 10 years. And yeah, I just decided one day life's going to be different. I came back. I took the wrong job when I came back. I spent 3 months, first of all, sitting on the couch, staring at the TV because I had no idea what to do. If I wasn't Melanie, the person who crosses the globe constantly and is always traveling and is always busy and works 70 hours a week, then who the heck am I? I had no idea. That shows you, I think, probably a bit of too much of an immersion in other people's businesses and in work. And so I came back and I didn't know who I was. So I sat on the couch and cried for 3 months, as you do, and then saw a job that I thought would be the perfect opportunity. It was for a global cosmetic company, and it was so the wrong choice. It was just a terrible, terrible, terrible choice. I was like a square peg in a round hole. I didn't get it. They didn't get me. it didn't work out so well. I lasted 1 year and 1 month, just long enough to take out quite a big bonus. I had a $32,000 bonus that I was able to work towards. And that $32,000 bonus, I took it and started my own business. I first of all joined a franchise called Small Fish Business Coaching, worked with them. And literally that transition from employee to self-employed was that I was being micromanaged in that last position I had, to a point where I felt degraded and humiliated, and I was starting to question my own knowledge and skills. And I had a real F you moment where I thought, hang on, you're micromanaging me and you don't know one fifth of what I know. I'm not doing this anymore. So I, you know, went onto the internet. I wrote down a list. It seems so weird, cheesy now, but I wrote this wish down of everything that I would like to do in a day. You know, I would like to help people with their businesses, and I'd like to explain profit and loss reports. How weird is that?
Sounds like, hey, I don't really do need you.
And so I had this real kind of, you know, list of, I really want to do this. And then a list of what I didn't want. I didn't want to be spoken to like I was an idiot. I didn't want to be micromanaged. I didn't want to conform to somebody else's ridiculous rules when they made no logical sense. I didn't want to be in a position anymore where I worked really long hours and that was a measure of success, because that logically made no sense to me. And so business coaching became kind of a bit of an obvious, I didn't know it existed up until that point. And then I wrote the list down and I went on to Seek Commercial and started Googling about, searching about, and this, you know, business coach opportunity came up, and I thought, holy crap, man, that's me. And that's, you know, that was my step into self-employment.
Yeah. From there to now, what, you started with Small Fish?
Started with Small Fish, and I absolutely loved it. They taught me so much, and I needed it. I needed that framework around me at that time. And then after a few years, I decided that I wanted to focus very much on women in business, and I wanted to have a very profit-driven focus. So it's Profit Lovers is my business. I wanted to be very specific in what I was doing. So I left the Small Fish umbrella to brand as something different, to kind of test the waters of what I wanted to be next. And then very soon after that, my mum was sick. Then you start questioning everything that you're doing. So from there, I decided I didn't really want to be that one-on-one coach swapping an hour of my time for some of your money. I wanted to do something bigger. I wanted to be more influential to people. This is this whole, like, I'm going to change the world thing.
I know.
And so that was that, you know, there's a bigger calling for me in the world, where I decided to use all of those skills and that voice to help women understand and appreciate the value of their businesses. So that's been the short notes of where it all came from, how it progressed to where I am. It was never something that I aim to do. I feel like it was just an evolution. I work in 3-year blocks. I don't plan to, but I've noticed that within my career that everything transitions at the 3-year point. And so I'm 6 years in now, and I feel like I'm now moving into that next step of my transition, which is, you know, the continuation of this online business that I've built, this weird, oh my God, you don't have to work hard for your money business, which feels still quite strange.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's on the couch.
Biggest fear.
God, this question, I have a stomach gut reaction to this question. My biggest fear, and I mean no disrespect to my mother because she had the most amazing heart. She was a very, very good woman. My biggest fear is to follow in her footsteps and to live that life of regret and be constantly reflecting on everything bad that was done to me and not use the skills or talent I have to make something very different. If in 15, 20 years' time I'm diagnosed with breast cancer and I'm in the same position she was, that would be a huge fear for me.
What do you struggle with?
I struggle with being a little bit too self-sufficient in that sometimes I forget the importance of relationships. And I think, I mean, that's very much a self-protection thing, right? That's something that, you know, definitely I learned that if you're only reliant on yourself, then there really isn't a whole lot of disappointment that can happen. The only person that you're in for disappointment with is yourself. And so I do find those relationships to maintain or to rely on someone else or to ask for help or to be honest when something's not going right. I find those quite difficult and sometimes quite uncomfortable. I met up with Kylie Patchett. We decided we were going to meet halfway between her place and my place, and we met in the town of Boona. As soon as I laid eyes on her, it was like, oh my gosh, this connection is so damn important. And I think I just forget sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. My best mate is Lisa Corduff, and, you know, we talk every day on the phone. Well, not every day, but most days when either of us is having one of those meltdowns, we're the go-to for each other. So there's a lot of ugly crying and stuff that happens with that chick. Yeah, and that is just so important to me to have those connections with women. And, in fact, that's really been the question that I've been struggling with right now is, you know, do I actually want an online business? Is that something that feeds my soul? Or is it actually the face-to-face connection that I'm currently missing?
The online business is not a unicorn business. It doesn't solve any of your problems. It's not a pot of gold at the end of a rainbow. It is a legitimate business with the same struggles and issues and limitations and frustrations as an offline business. It's just a different context. And so I think that's a really good question to ask. And I've started taking one-on-one clients again. I started about 3 or 4 months ago. For a year, I think I got a little bit overwhelmed and I absorbed a little bit too much, and I needed to control more about the access people were getting to me and how much I was taking on of their issues. And so I stopped for a year to kind of find my balance again. I think that one-on-one coaching is actually really important to me. And even though it's by far not the most profitable thing I could be doing, and if I had a business coach, I'm sure they would say, you know, why would you do that when you can, you know, make money, so, you know, online without a whole lot of effort. Not without a whole lot of effort. That's the wrong way to say it. But you can passive. Well, I don't like passive either.
Yeah, I don't either.
You can go online and you're not swapping time for money. Why would you want to have one-on-one clients? But those connections are so important. They really keep you in check with yourself. Human connection, I mean, I think particularly for women, is incredibly important. I think for me, I feel like I have very small group of very close girlfriends. I'm not interested in acquaintances. I don't do small talk. I'm a terrible networker because I don't care about your story. You know, I don't care about your story. I don't care about our surface chit chat. If we're going to get to know each other, I really want to know you. And if we're not going to do that in an honest way, then I kind of am not really interested. So, God, I sound like an asshole.
No, no, but you don't. I totally feel that too. It's like, for me, you know, I started my co-working space because I was had been working for myself for, I don't even know what it was, maybe 7 or 8 years, just supremely, desperately lonely. Wanted to find some people who were like me. And so I created this $100,000 business in order to fulfill this need that wasn't being met within me, which was connection with other people.
Yeah,
and
right.
So what I found through doing that was actually I found the connection just not through paying clients. So I had a little circle that would meet in my office every week and we would just, you know, talk about our business. It was like a mini mastermind, I guess. And through that, because I was at such a low point, every week I would go and I would cry. And I would just cry and cry and cry and cry. And they would sit there and just hold the space for me to cry. And through me doing that, I created incredibly strong bonds with people because they saw me, you know, like most of the time we're hiding behind this Instagram feed when and we're worried that the things that we say, what impact is that going to have on our, you know, persona or our brand or, you know, what people think of us. When if we want that kind of connection with people, we have to get real.
Oh, you have to share. You absolutely have to. I remember telling people, like my followers, my profit lovers, that I have a cupboard it's a linen cupboard, and I go in there when I'm panicking. I haven't been in there for a while, which is a very good sign. But when I was feeling very overwhelmed or I was starting to panic or I was getting upset, I would go in there and I would lie on the floor and I would just bawl my eyes out. Even to the point where I've got a little dog, Ziggy, who's at the groomers right now, who he knows, like if I go in there, because I live alone, I don't have that much linen, right? If we're going into the linen cupboard and mummy's not naked, ready for the shower, she's about to have a meltdown and he knows to come in with me and lie down with me. And so I would shut the door. It's quite a big linen cupboard. I'm not squeezed into a box, but it's got really soft carpet and it's really dark and it's always really cool in there. And so I would just lie on the floor and cry and cry and cry. And I shared that with my followers and I was surprised at some of the emails I got where people were saying, oh, like you're not perfect. And I think that kind of hurt my feelings because I thought, I'm not sure that I ever put the perception out there that I was. It's not my fault that you looked at my Instagram and decided that my life was perfect. I never said it was. It's almost like I had to share this really raw part of myself for them to go, oh, right, now I see who you are or I connect with you. So I think you're right. We do. We make these assumptions based on someone else's Instagram, not by what they're telling us.
Yeah.
But by what we believe to be true.
Absolutely. And I think it's very easy to look at someone else and what's happening for them and make big assumptions about it. You know, when that co-working space was going down, I can't tell you how many people contacted me and said, wow, you're really killing it, aren't you? And I was like, no, this thing's fucking killing me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not killing anything. Where did you even get that idea? You know? But they have this assumption that, here goes Carly with another huge project and look at her go.
She must be making so much money.
Oh, my God. She's smoking cigars wrapped in $100 bills. Look at that chick go. And it's like, no, that's not the reality.
One of the biggest bits of advice I give to women is that you will never, ever, ever know what is going on in someone else's business unless you have access to their figures.
Yeah.
Make no assumptions because I think that women assume everybody else is doing better than me or, you know, that person's really successful. My competitors, look how successful they are. Until you know at the end of the day what that profit number is, you don't know.
Yeah, so
and
true.
Yeah, you know, you need to be able to get into their tax records for that kind of information, which is none of your damn business. But you don't know. You will never, ever know. And that definitely comes from that childhood of, you know, we had very nice things because my dad stopped. we're very nice things. And I'm sure that it probably looked to a lot of people like we were doing very well. And my parents had this very much this keep up appearances, like we wore the best of everything. You know, I never, ever went without anything as a kid in terms of material things. I certainly went without, like, you know, parents telling you that you're supposed to be home by 5 o'clock, because I could go for days and nobody would say anything, or even homework. Nobody ever told me you had to do your homework. So nobody ever checked your report card. So that sort of stuff was missing. But the appearances stuff, you know, we went out always dressed in the best, and we got, you know, anything that we ever asked for. As an adult, I have that knowledge, not just because I'm a business coach and I see behind people's businesses, but also because I know how I was brought up, that you will never, ever know. You will never, ever, ever know what someone else has got going on.
Totally, totally. And there's different kinds of success too, right? It's like, even if that person does have a lot of profit in their business, it doesn't mean that the rest of their life is magical and that they're riding the white horse, you know. There's so many different aspects that make up a full life, and most of us are missing some of them.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Sales don't equate to, you know, profit. You don't know what their expenses look like. I definitely had a big wake-up call last year when I realized that profit-wise, I do a lot better than a lot of people, even though I felt like sales-wise, I'm like, oh, I'm so shit at this. I'm never going to get this. I shouldn't be in this online world trying to sell online courses. Other people are doing $300,000 a year, and I'm not, and I'm a bit shit. But at the end of the day, my profit's higher. So who gives a crap what somebody sells? So, and what did they have to do to make it? Were they working 70 hours a week, 80 hours a week? I remember I said to Kylie Patchett, it probably wasn't that long ago. And if you haven't picked up already, we are our little like mastermind buddies, and we had an instant connection. We were supposed to be meeting up on Skype to talk about sales funnels. We just had this weird instant connection, and it was a 4-hour conversation where we both bared our souls, which I'm sure, as you're also going to pick up from this, is not my natural way of being in the world, right? I'm quite reserved and quite not secretive, but I don't share too much about myself. And so we have this like relationship where we're brutally honest with each other. And I'd said to her, I want that. I want, you know, what that this other person has. And she said to me, no, you fucking don't. You absolutely don't. You know you don't. And she really called me out on it. And I was like, you know what? You're right. I don't want to spend my days flying all over the world. I don't want to do big presentations in front of people. I don't want to work 70 hours a week. I don't want the responsibility of having staff. I don't want anything that person's got at all. And so there's always that, you're going to kind of slap yourself when you're fantasizing about someone else's existence in the world, particularly based on their Instagram feed.
Yeah.
And like I said before, you can't control what someone else perceives of you as well. And so I don't want anybody to think that I'm perfect, or that I don't struggle in my own business, or that I don't have the same anxieties and fears that everybody else does. But if you make that assumption, then that's on you. It's not on me.
Totally. So what does failure mean to you?
Oh, failure. Ugh. That's a really good question. I don't know that I've ever really thought about it being a possibility. So then you don't really think about it. Failure. Okay, here I know what it is. It's going back to full-time work. That's failure. That would be, fuck this. My life is over. This is shit. Very dramatic response.
I had that exact response this morning.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't so long ago where I was sneaking back onto Seek to see if there was anything available. And then I realized I'm actually unemployable. Nobody wants me anyway. And I think that going back and even looking on Seek and looking at jobs is kind of probably saying taking that step would mean you're a failure, and maybe that's what you deserve anyway. So it's definitely a big habit to break, that wanting to put yourself in a position of failure. There is no reason why I would fail, because I know exactly how to make money. I know what to do, and I've proven time and time again that I can, but I still do go back to that space where I think it's all going to end. So that definitely would be failure, would be back working for somebody else, making somebody else a shit ton of money, because I spent 15 years doing that, making other people very wealthy and doing it in a way that was so self-sacrificing. Yeah, sure, I'll fly to another country and take your company over for the next 6 months to make sure it doesn't go under while you go on holidays. and buy brand new cars? Sure, I'll do that. Sure, I'll turn up at work at 8 o'clock in the morning after being on a 30-hour flight. Sure, I'll do that. No, that would be failure.
And so we've all got that evil bitch that resides in our head and tells us a bunch of untruths on a record. What does yours most commonly say at the moment?
At the moment, well, she changes. She's a sneaky cow. Yeah. At the moment, what does she say? At the moment, it is probably, this is as far as you're ever going to get. Like, just enjoy it. Be grateful for what you've got, and this is it. Don't be aiming any higher. Just keep hold of what you've got. And then that comes back to just making it all very complicated. You know, it has to be exactly the way it is right now. And if you change anything, it's all going to self-combust. It's going to implode. You've got to overthink it and make it more difficult and sweat it out. Yeah. That's probably the voice at the moment. She does change. You know, for a very long time it was, you can't have this because nobody else, you have no proof that anybody else has what you are aiming for, because most of my friends are employed, and obviously the family that I had was very different. And so there was never any visible proof around me that this could be achievable. And so there was a voice that was like, what's this bullshit job you've made up? What's this fancy world?
All right, so let's flip it a little bit. What does freedom mean to you?
Freedom is choice. It doesn't mean that I don't work really hard. Some weeks I will do 50 hours in my business. It's the choice to do 50 hours or to do 10. And it's choice in how I spend my time. It's choice in who I work with. It's choice in just how my business is in the world and how I am in the world. That choice that I can go on camera and not have any makeup on, and it's no one's damn business. I don't have an employer saying to me, you're not presented, you know, you need to be wearing full face of makeup, or somebody telling me how I should spend my time. That to me really stifles my feeling of freedom. And interestingly, you know, when you start an online business, you kind of have this fantasy that you're going to travel the world and work from a laptop. And I'm going to be sipping cocktails. And I've done that once. You know, I spent 2 weeks in Thailand. I've done that fucking once. That to me isn't actually freedom. The whole concept that people are chasing of this online business being this, like, you know, transient lifestyle and suitcase lifestyle, that isn't even freedom to me. It's nice to have, but the freedom is just the choice. I can choose where, when, who, how it's gone down.
Last question, success. What does that mean? What does it look like?
It's the same thing as freedom, it's choice. And so whenever I have the right to choose what's happening in my life, I feel like I'm very successful. Right now, I would say, even though financially I'm not at a point that I'd like to be, and even that's quite uncomfortable for me because I've only ever seen a certain level of income come in as I was growing up. We always lived a very certain way. And so now as I've far surpassed that, even that feels a little bit uncomfortable. And so, you know, the success really is, do I have all of the freedoms in the world to be able to choose what next week is going to look like? And that is so incredibly powerful in my life. And it's a weird one because it wasn't like I was ever not given those freedoms when I was growing up. I don't know where that's kind of come from, where this ability to make every choice for myself and control everything that's going on in my life, how that equates to success, but it definitely does. And so right now, I would say that I'm very successful by my own measure.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
You can connect with me over at theprofitlovers.com, and there is a whole heap of information over there if you want to run a business. And my whole thing about business and women is I'm going to show you the unsexy side of business, and I'm going to show you how to use it to get what you want from your business and what you want from life. I'm all about businesses being profitable, livable, and lovable. I think those three components for women are extremely important, and I think that it's rare to get three in balance, and that's what I want. So if you want a business that is profitable, livable, and lovable, something that actually makes you money, you're not pissing about trying to make ends meet while you're, you know, trying to save the world. You still need to feed your damn self and keep your kiddies clothed. So if you want that good combination of money coming in, lovable, that you feel like this is the right thing for you, you're not going to love your business every day. Nobody does. But lovable in that you feel like you're getting it. And then livable, that it fits in with what you want your life to be. If you want tools and resources, I share all my good stuff. I don't keep my good stuff hidden away. And so head on over there. If you're looking for woo-woo, if you're looking for me to make you feel good, you're probably going to be in the wrong place. I don't do woo-woo well. This is practical reality. Look at your numbers. Learn to read a profit and loss report. It's not going to damn well kill you. You know, start measuring. Start keeping check of yourself in your business. Start embracing the unsexy stuff that nobody talks about on Instagram.
The takeaway: exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper, and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
So much pressure. Okay, I'm just going to give you the one that I have found really powerful for me. And I actually have it framed on my desk. And it is, how easy are you willing to let this be? And so that's my little mantra. And if you stick it on a sticky note somewhere, business isn't complex. It really isn't. It isn't difficult. It's just a series of numbers, and the numbers work or they don't. The wheels turn or they don't. If you're not getting what you want from your business, one of the wheels is stuck and you need to oil it. And the more you know about your business, the more simple it all becomes. My business is so damn easy from the outside. It really is. When you take away all of the emotion and all of the baggage and all of the fear and all of the bullshit, it's really quite easy.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm so glad we had this chat, because this before, you know, this morning, I'm not going to lie, a few ugly tears have been shed today for me because I've allowed things to be personal. And yeah. Business is rarely personal.
I think my background, I've got a science degree, and so I have a naturally analytical brain. I see, and I think this is why I've done so well in business and why I get it, is because all I see when I look at anybody's business is a series of mathematical equations that make sense or they don't. And so that's all business is. And if you're not selling what you'd hope to be selling, then there is a problem with the numbers. And your only challenge is to identify where that is. And that's not that difficult, because you're taking every customer through a journey. At what point did they not continue along with you? It's not so difficult once you see your business in a skeleton, right?
And I think it's like, you know, I run a couple of businesses, one that has ticked along for the last 13 years and, you know, it goes, it's all good. It doesn't cost me a lot of time. It doesn't cost me a lot of energy. It's been a long time getting it to that point, and it provides for my family. It's awesome. But I find that what happens is, for a lot of women, is they go into this, you know, I have to find the thing that I've been put on the face of the earth to change the world. And then along with that, it becomes personal, because then Correct. They're like, this is my big responsibility, and this is why I'm here to share this. And when it's not, like, it's not propelling me to Oprah status, I'm a fucking failure.
Correct. We personalize so much about business, but business is nothing more than a set of turning wheels. That is it. A business doesn't have, you know, happiness or sadness, or, you know, it doesn't have those emotions. It just doesn't. We do, and then we apply them to our businesses to prove why we're fuck-ups. And if you can separate the two out and you can see yourself with your own set of issues, we're human. Businesses is very simple until you include people.
Yeah.
if you can separate yourself out and see yourself as the one that's holding all the bullshit and your business is purely a set of turning wheels and a set of numbers, then it becomes so much easier to manage your business. And that whole, how easy are you willing to let this be? What if my personal bullshit did I just dump all over my business to make it more difficult than it is? And that, I think, is probably the biggest lesson I can give any woman in business. It's just a set of turning wheels.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to the Carlosophies podcast with me, Carly Nimmo. Let's continue the conversation at carlynimmo.com. If you were a big fan of the podcast, I'd be stoked if you left a review. And if you want to hear more radness just like this, be sure to subscribe and spread the word. In the meantime, be real, be rad. Peace out.